Ready to roll again. My name is Fred Niedner, and this is part three of a series called The Bible Handles Hatred. We've looked at how Mark's gospel tried to help people cope with the hatred of the world and persecution. And we saw yesterday how Matthew's gospel tried to help people to defuse hatred within the community that comes from offenses and sins within a community that might threaten to tear a community apart. Today we're going to look at Luke and the kind of thing we'll call the hatred that Luke wants to help people get rid of or get beyond is a very different sort, and we'll eventually get to what that is. But I promised at the beginning of this series that there would always be some brief moment of humor at the beginning. I tried to think of some sort of humor that fit with Luke, and the best I could come up with was a little story that I think is apocryphal, but it ought to be true. It's a story that goes like this. There was a mother who asked her 6 or 7 year old daughter at about sundown if she wouldn't please go outside and pick up her toys that were scattered out on the sidewalk and the lawn, and the little girl said, "Well, I'm afraid, Mom, it's dark out there. I don't want to go out there. I want somebody to come with me." And the mom said, "Well, Jesus is with you. You don't need to be afraid." And the little girl said, "Well, yeah, I know that, but I want somebody with skin on their face." So I tell that because I think Luke's gospel tries to show us a way that we can be the skin on the face of Christ in this world. We are the skin and on the face and the hands and the feet of the only body that Christ has right now, ascended as he is to be with the Father. We are the body of Christ, the skin on the face of Christ, if you will. And Luke's gospel tries to help people see how they can be that in the world. For those of you that haven't been with us before, what we're doing in this series with the Gospels anyway is to take each Gospel one at a time and to look at unique features of each Gospel as clues to what particular kinds of problems, situations, or whatever each Gospel was attempting to help its readers to face up to. And Luke is the only gospel that gives us some very direct clues as to why it was written, for whom it was written, what circumstances it might be interested in. And we'll take a little look at that direct comment at Luke 1, verses 1 to 4 here at the outset. We've begun each day by looking at the opening verses, and will again today. "Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, I too decided, after investigating everything carefully from the very first, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the truth concerning the things about which you've been instructed." There's a lot of information in that one little paragraph. You know, it's not germane to the subject at hand, but among other things, it gives us a clue to something that we don't normally think about, namely that there were lots of these stories around already. By the time Luke is writing, Luke is a contemporary of Matthew, writing in the period about from 70 to 90 A.D. Also, like Matthew, followed Mark in constructing his gospel. 90% of Mark appears in Luke just as it does in Matthew. So we know one of the gospels that would have been around when Luke says there were many already have been put together by his time, but we don't know what others there might have been in circulation already when Luke wrote. There are many gospels and epistles that have survived which are not in the Bible, did not get into the canon. I checked between the early session and this one whether or not we have this in this library, and we don't. But there is a collection of all this stuff in something called the New Testament Apocrypha, a whole volume of Gospels and another whole volume of epistles that did not make it into the canon. Some of that stuff is so strange to our eyes and ears that we say, no wonder they didn't even think of putting this in. But some of it's very much like what we do have, and we can't really tell why that had to be left out. There are, for example, a bunch of Gospels which tell of Jesus' childhood. A Gospel that's known as the Gospel of Israel, Thomas the Israelite Philosopher, which tells all about Jesus' childhood, but you wouldn't have wanted to know the Jesus that Thomas the Israelite Philosopher tells about. He does things that get himself into trouble all the time and then finds a way out, like he makes on the Sabbath day a bunch of from clay that he's made from some mud. He makes a bunch of images of pigeons. Now the Torah clearly says, you shall not make unto thee a graven image of anything that's in the heaven above or the earth beneath or the sea below. And here Jesus makes, he's just a boy, 6-7 years old, makes clay pigeons on the Sabbath day. You know, two commandments down at once. So they come along, some authorities do, and confront him, and he says, away with you, and the pigeons come alive and fly away, and he says, what images? So he's got his tricks with which he gets out of trouble, which is fairly benign. But then a boy standing there at this scene takes a stick and messes up the water Jesus was using to make clay, and Jesus says, you insolent, godless dunderhead, what harm did the pools and the water do to you? And the boy immediately withers up and dies. Then he goes off to play, and he runs into, or another boy runs into him and doesn't apologize, and Jesus says, you shall not go further on your way, and the boy dies. They send Jesus to school, and the teacher tries to teach him the alphabet, and Jesus, they get two letters into the Greek alphabet, and Jesus says, if you tell me the meaning of alpha, I will tell you the meaning of beta. And the teacher says, what do you mean the meaning of alpha, the meaning of beta? You have to put them into words before they mean anything. Jesus says, no, each one has a meaning. I will tell you. And they get into an argument, and the teacher slaps Jesus for being insolent. Jesus kills the teacher. The moral of the story is, don't mess with Jesus. This is very dangerous, zapping, wunderkind Jesus in that gospel. And several of them are like that. In another one, Jesus, a bunch of children hide from Jesus and won't play with him, and so he turns them into goats and starts going around with all the goats behind him, and the mothers finally recognize that their children have been changed into goats, and so they say, oh, our dear Lord Jesus, truly you are the good shepherd. then he says, well, if you teach them to be nice to me, I will turn them back into children. And they promise, and so he does. And they all lived happily ever after, I guess. Some of it's really bizarre like that. Mm-hmm. But other stuff was a lot closer to what we understand as the authentic tradition, and so it was much more difficult to know what to do with it. Some of the more dangerous stuff includes another Gospel of Thomas, for example, that says at the end, as Jesus is about to depart from the disciples, that in Jesus' own words, that women are not really worthy of the new life, but if he changes them into males, they can enter the kingdom. And then he says the last line of the Gospel, for any woman who becomes a male may enter the kingdom of God. So what do you do with that? After, as the last part of a gospel, which sounds just like Matthew or Mark, for the most part. So there was some stuff around that caused some real problems. And it was difficult for the early church to decide what was the authentic stuff and what was perversions that got into the mix later on, and it was partly a problem because it was very difficult in times of persecution by the empire to have a big meeting and decide what's the real stuff and what's garbage. The dumbest thing they could have done during much of the early period was get together and have a meeting and put all the leaders in one place and risk having the empire find out where they were. So it all had to be done kind of informally. But that's another whole story, how we got the Bible that we got. But in any case, Luke knows there's a lot of stuff out there and some of it could confuse people. And so Luke is going to try to write an account that will set the record straight for Theophilus. And he is going to use some of this written stuff, and he knows eyewitnesses and other servants of the word who have been around from the beginning. And he'll use all of that to put together an orderly account. Well, we can tell a fair amount about what Luke might be interested in telling his particular audience by the address that he gives to his reader, Theophilus. Luke, by the way, is a Gentile name, Lucas. This is not an eyewitness. It's thought by some to have been a friend of Paul, because Paul, in the letter of Colossians, mentions that he's got a friend named Luke, who he calls the beloved physician. But this book, like all the others, is anonymous, and it's only a kind of guess that this gospel was written by Paul's friend Luke. So it may be that Luke came to know about all of this from Paul. But he writes for another Gentile, Theophilus. That's a Gentile name, a Greek name. It does mean lover of God or beloved of God. And so some people think it may be a way to address, you know, God lovers in general, or the beloved of God in general, a community. But the fact that he's referred to as, or this Theophilus is referred to as Your Excellency, has led others to say that this is perhaps a politician or someone of some position that you address with a title, Your Excellency. You know, we don't normally address each other that way unless we're being silly or we're in trouble or something. I never call my wife Your Excellency unless I think I'm in trouble. So this may well be somebody of position, and that theory is strengthened by the fact that there is a political agenda in Luke's gospel that does not appear in any of the others. For example, in Luke's gospel, when Jesus is put on trial, he's not put on trial for blasphemy, as he was in Matthew or Mark. The accusation against Jesus in Luke's gospel is that he has gone around provoking the people to uproar, or rabble-rousing as they call it, and trying to incite insurrection and tax rebellion. Now, totally different set of issues than ever gets raised in Matthew or Mark, for certain. You know, and so many scholars believe that that's a clue that Luke was writing at a time when someone had begun the rumor that Christians were potential insurrectionists, ready to stir up a tax revolt, and Luke was trying to put that rumor down by saying that is not true, and the first time that got cited, it was seen to be phony. So that's among the things that that lend credence to the theory that this was a politician, and Luke was writing about political kinds of concerns. Another piece of that is the tremendous popularity of Jesus in Luke. Yeah, those of you who were with us to look at Mark will recall that in Mark, Jesus was this terribly isolated individual who came out of nowhere, lived secretly, talked in code, was abandoned the moment he was arrested. No one had anything to do with him anymore. Disciples, friends, everyone leaves him and he dies crying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, as we'll see in Luke, Jesus is always surrounded by a multitude of disciples and friends. He is not abandoned at the end of the story. The whole multitude stays there with him, to be with him to the end, even though the officials taunt him and all the multitude leave the scene beating their breasts saying what a horrible thing this was. So Theophilus, you should know this. This was a very popular fellow. Multitudes of disciples this man had. This was not a secretive crackpot fellow. This was a very public, popular figure, Theophilus. So there is a kind of political set of concerns that permeate the Gospel of Luke that aren't in the other Gospels. But the theme we're most interested in does have to do with power. It's got to do with what you do with power. But under the umbrella of how the Bible handles hatred, it's power used to conquer a kind of hatred that's very different from the hatred of persecution or the hatred of internal quarreling. The kind of hatred Luke is interested in also goes by the name apathy or deliberate ignoring of others who are along life's way. When the Bible uses the word hate in English, it's often a translation of a word that doesn't mean to loathe or despise or to actively work against someone. It's a translation of a word that really means simply to choose against someone and to leave them behind. Jesus said, unless you hate your father or your mother, you're not worthy of me. He did not mean unless you loathe, despise, and find ways to undermine your parents, you can't be one of my disciples. What he meant was, if you have to choose between me and your family, if it comes to that, you have to choose me and leave those behind. The kind of hatred Luke is interested in is choosing simply to leave behind a certain kind of people. And we'll start now to look at what kind of people Luke does not want us to overlook or leave behind. We'll begin just a little bit later than what we saw as Luke's preface in the birth story, which, so those of you who have been here are tired of hearing me say this, we could spend a whole period on this elaborate, wonderfully constructed birth narrative in Luke. But I want to take note of something in chapter 2. Mark didn't have a birth narrative. Matthew did, which we didn't look at very carefully, but who finds out first after Mary and Joseph about the birth of Jesus in Matthew? Anybody remember?
Shepherds.
No, not in Matthew.
Elizabeth.
No, Elizabeth isn't in Matthew.
Oh, exactly.
In Matthew, it's the Magi see signs in the heavens and come to Jerusalem to talk to the king. The king gets all excited. And so you got foreign dignitaries and kings all in an uproar over Jesus' birth. In Luke, Luke mentions all those big dignitaries. In those days, a decree went out from the emperor Augustus that everybody should be registered, and the governor was Quirinius. So these people are around. And this is all happening in their time. But in the area where Jesus was born, there were shepherds in the fields keeping watch over the flock by night, and the angel of the Lord appeared to them. Forget the emperor. Forget the governor. It's the shepherds out in the fields who smell like sheep and never come to town, and we joke about them when they do. That's who we tell first. The shepherds out in the fields. So it's out in the fields people, the people that are easy to forget, that are always the first ones to be brought in on things in Luke's gospel. And over again that happens. Luke's gospel has a very important theme. It's the gospel for the little people, for the potentially forgotten and left behind. We're going to just take a quick sampling of things that are unique to Luke to see that theme, and then we're going to go to study Luke's passion narrative, which tells us how you can use power to choose for instead of against the little people and the outcasts. In Luke 6, verses 20 and following, there is a little piece which parallels the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. And there's a very significant difference in a couple of lines. Jesus says to the disciples, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be filled. Blessed are those who weep now, you will laugh." Does anybody happen to remember those sayings in a different version? The only other place they appear is in Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount. Yeah, in Matthew it's, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." And the hungry? Yeah, in Matthew it's, "Blessed are you that hunger and thirst for righteousness." In Luke it's plain hunger and plain poverty that we're worried about. Not these other, I don't know, values, perhaps we might call them in Matthew. Jump ahead then to Luke 14, verses 7 and following. There are a lot of banquet stories and banquet parables, which are stories of reversal, and the invited guests end up not coming, and the folks from the roadways and ditches end up in the banquet. But Luke has a kind of, this story is completely unique to Luke. It has a similar kind of tone. It's got to do with not trying to find a place of honor at a banquet, but taking a low seat and then being asked to come up higher. But the critical part that I want us to see this morning is in verses 12 and following. First part was if you're invited to a banquet. And this one is, if you give a luncheon or a dinner, don't invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your rich neighbors. They might invite you back over to their house. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. And the reason that'll be such a neat thing is because they can't have you back over. They can't repay you. You'll be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. So if you got food to share, that's who you want to have over to dinner. Choose against those who could pay you back. Choose for those who couldn't pay you back. Chapter 16. Verses 19 and following. Story of rich man and poor Lazarus. Another story that only appears in Luke. And we don't need to read it. I think it's well known enough and makes a clear enough point. A poor man was lying on the steps of a rich man who simply ignored him, chose not to even look at him. But when they both die, suddenly the rich man wants the poor man to be his water boy. But it doesn't work like that, sorry. You had your chance to be together with the poor man, and you lost it. If you don't choose to do anything about the poor, you will lose your chance forever. Chapter 19, verses 1 to 10, are another story peculiar to Luke. Story of Zacchaeus, who was a little person in a number of ways. He was short of stature, but also of little account in the eyes of the pious folk because of being a tax collector and thus a collaborator with the empire. But Jesus goes to little Zacchaeus' house and eats with him, has table fellowship, which in those days was a way of saying, I count myself among your kind of folk. Whatever they say about you, they should say about me. And so Jesus chooses not to ignore or overlook the outsiders. Well, that's just a sampling of things that are unique to Luke, that are messages about what you do if you have opportunity or power to do something on behalf of the little ones, the outsiders, the no accounts, the poor, or whatever. Then, Luke has I hesitate to call it a program, but it's something like a program that Luke has in his gospel for how you go about doing this. How you go about becoming a person that will choose for the little ones and not ignore them. And it begins in chapter 9. Luke 9, verse 23. About halfway through all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus begins to predict that he will be abused and killed and ultimately rise again after he goes to Jerusalem. And in all the Gospels, in all the Synoptics, he says then, at the point where we find Luke in verse 23 here, if any of you want to follow along now up to Jerusalem, if you want to be one of my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. That's what Mark says. If you want to be my disciple, you must take up your cross and follow me. That's what Matthew says. If you want to be my disciple, you must take up your cross and follow me. Luke says, if you want to be my follower, you must deny yourself and take up your cross daily and follow me. Luke's the only one that has that little word in this cross-bearing saying. And I think that's significant. In Mark's audience, as we saw, it's very likely that if you ever picked up a cross, it would be a real live wooden cross, and in about 15 minutes you would be on it, and it would be the last cross you ever carried. Because that was a very real possibility for Mark's audience. Persecution and death for the sake of the faith. Or as one of my students put it a few years ago in Mark's gospel, if you don't look good on wood, get out of the business. It's sort of crass, but I keep repeating it for some reason. But in Luke's audience is not facing probable death for the sake of their Christianity. Luke's audience is among the people that have a say about who's going to be hurt and who isn't. Luke's politically connected audience may, in fact, have the power to choose for or against persecution. So Luke's audience doesn't need to learn how to die faithfully, maybe this afternoon or tomorrow or next week. They need to learn daily cross-bearing. Cross-bearing for the long haul. What might daily cross-bearing look like? Well, it so happens Luke shows us a day of cross-bearing. That's what one of the functions of Luke's passion narrative is, a day of cross-bearing. So let's skip ahead to chapter 23. Thank you. we'll skip over the arrest and trial and so forth at this point and jump right up to chapter 23, verse 26, when they're ready to take Jesus off and crucify him. As they led him away, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, and they laid the cross on him. It happens in Matthew and in Mark as well. But then Luke adds the little line, and they made him carry it behind Jesus. So this isn't a monumental detail, but by adding that little prepositional phrase, Luke provides us a more visual picture of exactly where Simon of Cyrene was in relationship to Jesus. He was behind him in his footsteps, following Jesus as a cross bearer. Okay? So Simon of Cyrene is much more obviously in the role of cross bearer in this gospel. So Simon of Cyrene is about to go to cross bearing school and learn what a day of cross-bearing looks like. And then a whole sequence of things begin to happen that are unique to Luke. A great number of people followed him, and among them were women beating their breasts and wailing for him. Remember, he was totally abandoned by everybody who cared about him in Mark, but this multitude of his friendly followers are still with him in Luke, and they're very upset. Jesus turns to them and says, "Daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me, but for you, for your children. Days are coming that those of you who are mothers are going to wish you didn't even have children. It's going to be so bad. You'll wish mountains would fall on you and it'd just be over with. Don't cry for me. Cry for yourselves. Let's worry about you." To others, were led away to be put to death. They came to the place of execution. Jesus is crucified, a criminal on either side, and Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Only in Luke does that line appear. The people stood by and watched, but the leaders of this mob scoff at him. One of the criminals who was hanged with him derided him. The other speaks on behalf of Jesus. So even one of the fellow crucified is friendly to Jesus in Luke. And Jesus cares for him. "Please remember me," says the fellow. Jesus says, "All right, I will." So that's the picture of a man walking his way toward whatever moment his death will come. Who is he concerned about as he walks his way toward death, whenever it might be? Everybody else. He's concerned about the people who are sad for him. He's concerned about the people who are killing him. He's concerned about the people dying with him. That's a day of cross-bearing. Everybody along your way is part of your concern. And he doesn't stop to do anything for himself so far. Now, where do you get the courage or the strength or whatever it is that it takes to make a day of cross-bearing like that, you know, caring for all those others? It's, we should pause here for a moment before we figure out how he did it. It's been going on for a while, but we wouldn't have noticed until Simon picked that cross up and we realized we were doing cross-bearing school. This has been going on at least since the arrest. Let's go back for a moment to chapter 22, verses 50 and following. As Jesus is being arrested, somebody struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. In Mark's gospel, Jesus says, hey, no more of this. In Matthew's gospel, he says, hey, I got angels galore. We don't need any of this kind of stuff. Cut it out. In Luke's gospel, he says, no more. But he touched his ear and healed him. We can't go on until we got these people fixed. We can't just let some hurt guy be ignored. Then we end up with Jesus arrested. And in Luke, unlike in Mark and Matthew, they don't go immediately into the high priest's place and have a nighttime trial and another one in the morning. In Luke, there's only one trial, and it's the next morning. They spend the night sitting out in the courtyard in verses 54 and following. They seized him and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house. Peter followed at a distance. They made a fire and sat in the courtyard together. Peter sat among them. So they're all there, out there with a fire lit, waiting for morning when they can talk to the high priest. Then somebody, a servant girl, sees Peter in the firelight, stares at him and says, this is one of them. He denied it. I don't know him, woman. A little later, someone else says, you're one of them. Peter says, no, man, I am not. Hour later, somebody else says, yes, you are. You're a Galilean. We can tell by your accent. You're one of them. Peter says, I don't know what you're talking about. At that moment, while he was still speaking, the cock crowed and the Lord turned and looked at Peter. So it's not like Jesus is inside confessing everything. Peter is outside denying everything. They're all sitting around a fire, and Peter's denying, and Jesus is right there. Peter denied him right to his face in Luke's gospel. And what did Jesus do? Yeah. All he had to do...
turned and looked at him.
All Jesus had to do, though, to sort of drag Peter down with him was smirk, you know, chuckle, or even, you know, get the wrong look on his face. And they know. But Jesus allows Peter to escape. So, I mean, there's other ways you could read that scene and the motives and the meaning of Jesus looking at him, but at the very least, he doesn't drag Peter down with him. So Jesus is concerned about everybody else along the way. Okay, now, how does he come by the strength and the courage to do that? That, in my estimation, can be seen in the way Jesus dies. In Luke, he does not cry, my God, why have you forsaken me, or anything like that in Luke, as he does in Matthew and in Mark. Verse 46 of chapter 23, Jesus, crying with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. And the centurion, when he saw that, praised God and said, this guy was innocent. And the crowds go home. Well, it's not Psalm 22, as it is in Matthew and Mark, but it is a psalm verse. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. O God, my faithful God, is Psalm 31, verse 5. What you need to know about that in order to understand what Luke has done is that that psalm verse was, for many centuries by Jesus' time already, the bedtime prayer that Jewish moms had taught their babies as the first prayer they taught them. Like we teach kids, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. So at the end of his day of cross-bearing, Jesus prays his bedtime prayer that he'd been praying all his life. And, that's all he needed to do. So he can walk that kind of a way toward whatever moment his death might come, knowing that at the end of every day, his life is going to end up in the same place. No matter what happens, he will end up in the hands of the Father. Whether it's asleep and alive at the end of the day, or whether it's as dust finally one day, he will still end up in the hands of the Father. And so there's this form of childlike trust, I guess, that Luke tells us is what it takes to be a compassionate caregiver along life's way, choosing not to overlook the little people, and even those who are bent on destroying you or whatever. I'll stop there for a moment for some questions. This is a dangerous idea, so there does need to be something else said about this that Luke does say.
When you come to the part about the thief on the cross, and some places it said, Jesus assured him, today you will be with me in paradise. You didn't mention that.
No, I didn't explain all what that might mean, no. But do you have a question about it?
Well, there's usually a lot of questions about it. Today.
Yeah, it always raises the subject of exactly what happens at the moment of death. You know, and there's all sorts of teaching and speculation and whatnot. I didn't go into it simply because I was after this other theme. Did you have a comment about it, or do you want to?
No. I was just waiting for you.
Oh. It's an odd thing. Paradise, for example, that's a Persian word. Paradise is the name that the Persians use for the place that you went if you passed the test when they put you on trial at the end of your life, to see if you were on the side of the God, the good God, or the evil God. You know, and why we have Jesus using the Persian word paradise is kind of mysterious.
Is it because it's written for a Gentile audience rather than a Jewish audience?
I don't really know.
What would the Jewish equivalent have been? The kingdom of heaven? Or what was the word that they would have used instead of paradise?
I don't know that there was a full-blown concept of a specific place with a specific kind of afterlife, you know, in the Jewish tradition at this point.
Bosom of Abraham?
Bosom of Abraham is the way it is in that parable, yeah. Both Lazarus and the rich man die, and the rich man ends up in Hades, which is a Greek word for where punishment or eternal punishment, and the poor man ends up in the bosom of Abraham.
The rocking chair.
In a rocking chair.
Psalm 23, in the house of the Lord forever.
Yeah. So lots of images come out. Do you have a question? Or?
I think the scripture that she's talking about for the thieves there, help me. Is it not true that then, because of his faith in Christ, he would be with him in paradise?
Yeah, I know, and that's a good way to look at it. Just by casting his lot with Jesus at this moment, you know, he is with Jesus. Wherever Jesus ends up, he will be with him. Yeah, so they are together, come what may, from this point on.
Yeah. Where the other thief is still denying him as being Christ.
Yeah. If you think about it, this is really kind of ironic. Here's a guy that's been dressed up like a king and beaten and abused, and he's about to die, and here's some crook who may or may not have known anything about this fellow who's dying next to a guy that's been dressed up like a king, and over his head it says King of the Jews. He doesn't know from diddly what this is all about. He's not one of Jesus' disciples. And he looks over there and sees this guy that says, King of the Jews, you know, it's not beyond imagination. And he said, well, remember me, King. Whatever kind of king you are, you know, I'd like to be one of yours. You know, It didn't look like a very good kingdom to be in on at the moment.
No. So there's a but at that last second, everybody has the opportunity to do a lot of thinking.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing that this text is always used for is to make clear some things about some of the requirements and rituals that are often said to be a necessary prerequisite for being saved, you know. And as I once heard somebody say, notice what Jesus does not say when this fellow says,
baptize.
Yeah, get a bucket, quick, baptize this guy. It's just, if you trust this one, you're in. You know, it's as simple as that.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, wouldn't this be the natural conclusion to a day of cross-bearing? In other words, that here is a promise for the looking community, that is to say that they're being instructed to take up their cross daily and to follow Jesus. And so if they do take up their cross daily and follow Jesus, then Jesus will remember them and mm-hmm. they will be with Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where the road leads, finally. Yeah. Well, I said a moment ago, this is a dangerous idea. A lot of people have done themselves and ultimately others great harm by thinking that the goal was to utterly deny oneself and to pay attention only to everybody else along the road. You know, and there is always the potential when you do that that you can run yourself into the ground and end up with nothing to give to anybody. And it happens to a lot of people. You know, nowadays we have fancy names for it, burnout, and whatever. I mean, it's a form of self-destruction that you can fall into very easily if you try to do this. So there are some other things you need to know about that road that Jesus is walking. And one of the places where an important thing to remember about all this appears is in Luke 10, in another road story. There are a lot of road stories in Luke. They're always traveling in Luke. And finally, Jesus' arrival after this long travel is what the climax of Luke is about. So one of the most important road stories gives us the corrective for not getting ourselves burnt out. Luke 10, verses 29 and following is the very familiar story of the Good Samaritan. We want to back up to verse 25 to find out what's at stake. A lawyer stood up to test Jesus and said, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Which doesn't mean, how can I get a ticket to heaven? It's also, how can I live a life that counts for something? How can I live a life that's a life worth having lived? So he said to him, "Well, what does it say in the Torah? What do you read there?" He answered, "Well, you love the Lord your God with your heart, soul, and strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself," quoting from two pieces of Torah, Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Jesus says, "Right, you got it. Do that, and you have a life that counts for something." But then, wanting to, as Luke puts it, justify himself somehow, that is, he wants to get this really straight. He says, "And who is my neighbor?" So Jesus tells the famous parable. A man going from Jerusalem to Jericho falls into the hands of robbers who leave him lying half dead, and a priest and a Levite pass by and choose not to do anything about him. A Samaritan comes along, and as Jesus puts it in the parable, he, my Bible says, took pity on him. Some Bible say he had compassion on him. And he got him out of the ditch, cleaned him up, puts him on the pack animal, takes him to the motel, pays the bill, and then he is at least in good hands. Whereupon Jesus asks the man then, "Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?" He said, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus says, yep, go do likewise. Well, this is a very complicated story in some ways, simple story in other ways. What's the answer to the man's question? Who is my neighbor?
He doesn't answer
everybody.
Who's in? Okay, well, we got two answers here, two responses.
He gave the answer to who was the neighbor to the man in trouble, not who was my neighbor.
If we stuck our finger over verse 36 and stopped with the response of the Samaritan to the man, the answer to the question, who is my neighbor, is?
A good Samaritan.
Is it a good neighbor or a bad neighbor?
No. The man, the lawyer, is trying to understand what it means to love God and his neighbor as himself. And he says, who is my neighbor? And Jesus tells a story about somebody who's hurt, who gets ignored by two guys, helped by one guy. Who is my neighbor? At first it sounds like if you find somebody in the ditch, that's your neighbor. Do something about it. Right? Everybody you meet along life's way who's in the ditch is your neighbor and your responsibility. You cannot choose not to do something about people in the ditch. But Jesus doesn't let it go at that. He says, you know, he asks this question at the end. Now, which one is the neighbor in the story? And it's not the man in the ditch. It's the man on the road who did something about the man in the ditch. Now, how does the man on the road get to be the neighbor?
By acting like one.
Why did he act like one? Why did he act neighborly?
Because he had compassion.
Because he had compassion. Yeah, there's the clue. In Greek, that word is splanchnizomai. It means to have your entrails stirred up, which is dangerous business, if you know about anatomy. It's an attempt to translate a Hebrew and Aramaic word, which is... the word for, it's a plural form of the word for womb. The Hebrew category of compassion is to womb someone. And most literally it means to treat someone like mothers treat people that remember, that they remember having been inside them, kicking around and loving them before they were ever born. And even when those people are 35 and do stupid things, you still love them. Because they're your flesh and blood. You know, they're still you in a certain sense that you're connected to them. That's compassion in the Bible's understanding. And so this Samaritan, when he sees this guy in the ditch and has compassion, he realizes that's not just somebody else in the ditch. His own flesh and blood is in the ditch. He's a Samaritan. He knows what ditches are like. He's been in the ditch of life much of his life. And when he sees somebody in the ditch, he knows what that's like. That's him in the ditch too. And so he does something about it.
But it's easier to have compassion if you've been in the other fellow's footsteps.
That's true.
Than if you have never experienced the
going. That's true.
Which is why poor people give more of their income away than rich people do.
Yeah, that's...
the document.
Yeah. But the point in response to the original question, what do you do to live a life worth living, namely love God and your neighbor as yourself, what the parable says is the only way to be a neighbor is to first love yourself. Because that's you there in the ditch, not just somebody else. That's you in the ditch. Would you like to be lifted out of the ditch if it was you? Of course you would. So you, in the act of responding to the other, you are also loving yourself. So you cannot love another without loving yourself, is a part of the message here. If you can't love yourself, there's no way you'll ever love your neighbor. Now the other two guys, they did what they did because they thought they were loving God. Because the Torah says, if you touch a dead body, especially if you're a priest or a Levite on your way to work at the temple, you have to go through a bunch of days of purification and you won't be able to do what you're supposed to do at the temple. And with a man lying half dead, as the text says, in the ditch, there's only one way to tell a half dead person from a whole dead person. Unless you got a mirror in your pocket like they do in cowboy movies and can put it up here and see if there's breath coming out of the nostrils, you got to touch the person. And then if he's dead, well, so much for your work on God's behalf at the temple. But a Samaritan is unclean to begin with. Samaritan and dead body are about in the same category in terms of piety. But the Samaritan can act compassionately. And I think this is Luke's way of saying that you cannot separate love of God from love of self and love of neighbor. Those three are so intricately tied up that you can't separate them finally. If you're missing one of them, they're all somehow out of whack. And so when you think about the life of daily cross-bearing, it does not mean living a life in which you do not love yourself. It still includes loving God and loving your neighbor as you love yourself.
Could there also be an element of loving my neighbor in the sense of loving the person, allowing the other person to minister to them? The Samaritan is the one who pulled the man out of the ditch. You know, and I love mm-hmm. that neighbor by allowing that person to give to me.
Yeah. Yeah, that raises a real interesting point about the story. You know, would the man, if he was the man in the ditch, if he was conscious, want a Samaritan to touch him? You know, or would the man listening to the story, if he were in the ditch, would he like to be helped by a Samaritan?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting when Jesus said, "Who is the one who showed mercy?" This lawyer couldn't say the Samaritan. He said the one who helped.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Well, it's four after, so I presume we have used up the tape. Thank you very much. Those of you who are still around tomorrow, we'll do John. See a whole different kind of thing.